Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Brian today. On today's show, you may have heard about a predicted tipping point when America will become a majority-minority nation. But what about a majority-multicultural nation? That tipping point is tomorrow. A march is planned for Saturday on Staten Island to protest the death of Eric Garner. We'll talk with former Governor David Paterson, who plans to attend. A disillusioned doctor diagnoses what's ailing the American medical system. And we get your suggestions for what to do in the waning days of summer. What's on your summer bucket list? But first,
ISIL speaks for no religion. Their victims are overwhelmingly Muslim. And no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and what they do every single day.
That's President Obama condemning the Islamic militant group ISIS, also called ISIL. He was, of course, responding to the video ISIS released Tuesday showing the execution of American journalist James Foley. We learned overnight that Special Operations Forces tried and failed to rescue Foley and others earlier this summer. And also that ISIS had demanded a ransom for Foley's release, which the U.S. refused to pay. That video also issued a direct challenge to President Obama: stop the airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq, or another American journalist will be killed. As so many times before in his presidency, Obama appears faced with a host of bad options. And perhaps you have a sense of deja vu as well. A dozen years ago, another American journalist, Daniel Pearl, was executed on video in similar fashion as the U.S. struggled with how to confront a brutal terrorist group. Joining us now to sort through all this is George Packer, staff writer for The New Yorker. George, welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show.
It's good to be with you.
You wrote a short piece for the latest issue of The New Yorker, written, I assume, just before this video came out, in which you write, quote, "It's hard to believe that the ambitions of ISIS will remain confined to the boundaries of the Tigris and Euphrates." Does the execution of James Foley confirm those fears?
Well, I think he is the first American to be killed by ISIS, and has certainly captured the attention of the American public and government because of that. But it's clearly the kind of thing that Al-Qaeda and its offshoots have always done in order to try to elicit, to provoke a reaction and sometimes an overreaction, which plays into the hands of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. And so, yeah, I mean, the guy who did the grisly deed of beheading James Foley was clearly taunting President Obama and America and the West and saying, you know, we're going to do this again and again unless you change your policy, which, of course, they know won't happen. So it does seem to be part of a really ugly game that is played in order to try to get the superpower to fall into a trap.
Well, and as has been much remarked upon, the militant in the video appears to be British. You also note in your New Yorker piece that many ISIS fighters come from the West.
Yeah, and it seems that some of their most zealous and brutal fighters come from the West, which actually doesn't surprise me at all. Anyone who would give up a life in London or the Midlands or Paris or Belgium or wherever, or Florida, to go fight in the badlands of Syria and Iraq is driven by, you know, something other than thrill-seeking. And there's a ferocious ideology at the heart of ISIS that even makes Al-Qaeda seem like a kind of slightly more old-fashioned, moderate version, because they are practicing what Al-Qaeda preached in an unprecedented way, slaughtering entire communities, or at least trying to, that don't practice the version of extremist Sunni Islam that ISIS thinks is the only true religion, and trying to establish facts on the ground, a state with a capital and an army and tremendous amount of money and arms and resources to sell to continue to fund their operations. Al-Qaeda didn't do that. So this is something new. And my guess is that policymakers and experts all over the West are trying to figure out what this new thing is and how it can be combated.
Well, and of course, we know that Al-Qaeda actually expelled ISIS because they felt that ISIS was actually too brutal even for them. I want to
imagine that.
Right, right.
It's almost a punchline. Yeah.
I just want to talk about a couple of the things that we learned in the last 24 hours. First of all, I mean, what do we know about the attempted rescue of James Foley earlier this summer?
Well, all we know is that, and I only know what you and other readers of the papers know, which is that. There was an attempt by special forces and by helicopter with some fixed-wing aircraft to go into the Syrian desert. They thought they had intelligence on where some of the hostages were being kept, not just Foley but others. When they touched down, the hostages weren't there. There were some terrorists there. Apparently there was a firefight. They say some terrorists were killed. One American was slightly injured. It was a failure, a tragic failure, because it could have averted the terrible end that that James Foley met the other day and that others might meet in the coming days. And I think we should all be braced for more of the same. So apparently the administration didn't want to reveal this because of, you know, the security of the operation and the desire to be able to perhaps try a second time. And some news organizations had already gotten the story, and we're about to go to press, and so the administration got out in front of them and, on background, told reporters about it.
Also, this morning, the Times was reporting that ISIS made a ransom demand for Foley. I think $100 million, along with other demands for release of certain allies being held in the U.S. or elsewhere. And the U.S. refused to pay this ransom, but many, if not most, other governments don't refuse to pay. Isn't that right?
That's right. And the reporter had written a brilliant piece a few weeks ago about terrorist kidnappings in North Africa, mostly, and Yemen to some extent, in which she delineated exactly what the method is for the kidnappings, for the negotiations, for the ransoms. It's become ritualized. And therefore, you know, if you want $5 million per head, you go after a Dane, an Austrian, an Italian, a Frenchman. You don't go after a Brit or an American. If you want to kill someone, that's who you go after, because it's become quite clear that of all the governments in the world, the British and American governments will not negotiate or pay ransom. And that was when James Foley, in his last moments, was talking about the ill luck of being an American. He seemed to be referring to the fact that that others had been ransomed and he had not. And it's quite a remarkable story that the European governments, while publicly lying and denying that they're doing this, are doing it, and they're funding Al-Qaeda in North Africa and in the Arabian Peninsula to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars and most of its operating funds. And they're also encouraging further kidnappings. So it's something that really needs to be publicly discussed in Europe and in this country.
And in fact, David Rowe, the journalist kidnapped by the Taliban, who perhaps survived only because he escaped, said yesterday that indeed the payment of ransoms and abduction of foreigners has to emerge from the shadows. He said it has to be publicly debated. American and European policymakers should be forced to answer for their actions. And I guess meaning that they have to be forced to answer for these conflicting actions that aren't being, I suppose, coordinated in any way.
That's right. In fact, governments are lying to each other about what they're doing. And if anyone has a right to demand a public accounting, it's David Rode, who's a friend of mine. And it turns out that just recently, just in the last few days, I think, four more European and three European and one Japanese reporters and aid workers were kidnapped in northern Syria as ISIS overran about a dozen villages near the Syrian-Turkish border. And so we will go through it all over again. And The real shame of it is that these are all kept hushed. First of all, to try to preserve the, you know, the secrecy of the negotiations, and second, to save face. And so these things have happened over the last decade without any acknowledgement and with very little reporting. But the Europeans go back home and are greeted as heroes at the airport, and the Americans and the Brits never return.
This is the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson in for Brian Lehrer. We're talking with George Packer. He's a staff writer with The New Yorker. He's the author of many books, including The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, and The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. We heard President Obama, a little clip at the top of the segment there, and I wanted to ask you to actually to kind of reflect on his tone. I mean, he sounded genuinely angry and upset, which I thought was quite a contrast to what seemed kind of a flat, listless tone in his presser on Ferguson earlier this week. Having observed this president's response to and approach to events in Iraq and the Middle East, could I ask you to jump inside his head for a moment? I mean, what do you think the rise of ISIS means to him and to the Obama presidency?
It's a truly unwelcome and unwanted threat, but I have the sense that he is more and more coming to regard it as something he has to give a great deal of attention and energy to. You could look at the different key points along the road, and I would say June, when ISIS overran the second largest Iraqi city, Mosul, and began pushing out or killing Christians and other religious minorities, was one, when the president said we were going to send several hundred military advisors to Iraq. Those advisors are staffing these joint operations centers that we've set up in Baghdad and in Erbil in Kurdistan to coordinate attacks on ISIS by ground forces, by the Kurdish Peshmerga and by the Iraqi army. But we hadn't sent in any air power. And then came the threatened genocide of the Yazidi minority west of Mosul in early August. And that seems to have been the real turning point when the president decided, you know, genocide was something he could not allow to happen. And so we began with airstrikes. And that's when those joint operation centers really began to earn their pay, because they had to coordinate intelligence, airstrikes, and two different ground forces, which not only don't coordinate with each other, but don't like each other and have come close to fighting each other, the Iraqis and the Kurds. So our presence there, even though it's very light in terms of numbers, is essential. And the airstrikes have dealt the first real military blows to ISIS that it's had in its 18 months of existence. And apparently the Mosul Dam was regained by the Iraqis and the Kurds. And we will see if threatened peoples in other towns, such as Amirli, which is a Shiite Turkmen town south of Kirkuk, is rescued, where thousands of people are under siege by ISIS. I mean, ISIS continues to be on the offensive, both in Iraq and in Syria, really especially in Syria. Apparently, they're very close to taking the large city of Aleppo and then the city of Hama. And they're on the offensive. They have the momentum in Syria. And in Iraq, they hardly seem to have been thrown back very much yet by the American intervention. So to answer your question, which is impossible, of course, about what's going on in the president's head, my boss, David Remnick, wrote a piece about Putin and Russian nationalism in The New Yorker last week. And in it, he quoted someone saying that Obama is a realist who feels bad about it. And I think that is the single best description of Obama's foreign policy thinking that I've ever read. And to be a realist and feel bad about it in Iraq and with ISIS is a very complicated thing. What does it mean? Does it mean you regard ISIS as a limited threat and just try to contain it? Does it mean you accept that there has to be a much stronger American and international push against it, and you put the last 2 years of your administration into building that coalition? It's very hard to know how he's going to figure this one out, because it's such a difficult one.
Well, and Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes was on NPR this morning, suggesting that at least the steps that the administration is going to be taking right now are to try to build up a coalition of nations in the region to combat ISIS, which sounds a little vague. I wonder what you think the administration's options really are now. I mean, because in a certain way, it seems like with these latest developments, protecting the Yazidis on Mount Sinjar may have been the easy part.
Yeah, that's actually true. And we did a good job of that. And that seems to have been largely done. Whereas rolling back ISIS, taking back territory, hurting them militarily, and protecting other threatened people is much harder. And it does seem like the mission has expanded. I mean, on August 8th, the president basically said, or was it August 7th, he basically said, we're going to protect the Yazidis and also defend American personnel and assets in Baghdad and Erbil. Well, we're beyond that now. And we're considering helping sheikhs in Anbar province who have risen up against ISIS. We're fighting around the Mosul Dam. So the mission has crept inevitably. The coalition is a vague thing, but I think it's the essential thing, and it's the sort of thing that Obama is well suited to do. It fits perfectly with his multilateral idea of foreign policy. You have the Turks, who have a border with Syria that is now maybe 6 miles away from some ISIS positions. The Turks need to be brought on board in terms of sealing that border so that recruits and weapons can't go across it, and oil can't be smuggled and sold to other countries, and to including some countries that are fighting ISIS. Iran has to be talked to, because Iran is about 20 miles away from ISIS positions, and Iran is, in some ways, the capital of the enemy faith, Shiism, which ISIS may regard as its single greatest enemy in the region. And even Bashar al-Assad, and this is the really bitter pill to swallow, may have to be included in discussions, because right now the Syrian army seems to be the only ground force capable of taking on ISIS in Syria, since the moderate rebels have pretty much been destroyed around Aleppo. So it's hard to know exactly what it would not be a formal coalition. It would be a set of talks with some governments that we don't like. The Saudis are essential here. Qatar is essential in terms of shutting off the flow of money to ISIS. So there's a lot that can be done. And then there's Europe, which is forever waiting for the United States to take the lead. Europe seems to have been jolted by the Yazidi crisis and by the Foley beheading. And suddenly we're hearing about weapons for the Kurds and perhaps airstrikes. So I think the world's attention has finally, after months and years, been riveted to this organization, and it's about time.
We're talking with George Packer, a staff writer at The New Yorker here on WNYC. I mentioned earlier the echoes that, of course, the James Foley execution has of the Daniel Pearl killing 12 years ago. I actually want to play two little sound bites here. The first is President Bush in 2002, immediately after the killing of Daniel Pearl. And then the second is from that press conference or statement yesterday that President Obama gave after the killing of James Foley.
These crimes only hurt their cause and only deepen the resolve of the United States of America to rid the world of these agents of terror.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
I play those two clips, which are obviously very similar, because of what happened in between them, right? Of course, the U.S. continued to occupy Afghanistan for over a decade, invaded Iraq, by many accounts, largely routed al-Qaeda, killed Osama bin Laden. And here we are 12 years later in an eerily similar situation, facing an organization perhaps even more brutal than al-Qaeda. One, I think, could be forgiven for wondering, what was all that for?
Yeah, there's something truly dispiriting about hearing those two clips together and thinking of all the suffering and tragedy of the decade in between and how little has been accomplished and how, in some ways, yeah, we're in the same spot. We should have learned things by now. I mean, that's what I hope the decade has meant to President Obama and to all of us, that we've learned lessons and we have to be willing to face them really squarely and then to act in the face of them. And one lesson is not to overestimate military power. I mean, that is one of the great lessons of both Iraq and Afghanistan, and not to underestimate the importance of politics, local politics. We understand Iraq a lot better than we did 10 years ago. And the Iraqi government, which now has the possibility of a new prime minister who could possibly rally not just his own Shiite political base, but Kurds and Sunnis against ISIS. We have to do, again, in tandem with the Saudis and the Iranians, who have a lot of influence, certainly more than they did back then, and we have less, but we have to try to support that government and get it to be the inclusive one that the Maliki government wasn't. There's a lot of other things that, you know, have been in the hardest way possible brought home to us, and that means not don't act at all, don't be paralyzed by the tragedy and failure of the Iraq War, but learn from it in a way that allows us to deal with this threat more intelligently and more successfully. But the larger lesson is radical Islamism is going to be with us for a long time. The fact that we left Iraq doesn't mean radical Islamism leaves the world stage. If anything, it's been emboldened and is now rampaging through Syria and Iraq. It has its own life. It has its own reasons. It isn't only a response to American foreign policy or anyone else's foreign policy. And if we can accept that, then we have to accept that we're going to be in for a very, very long struggle, which has to be conducted more intelligently and skillfully and with, you know, with more knowledge than we showed when we reacted to 9/11 in the way that we did.
Well, and I have to ask you, George Packer, considering that there are all these there are so many voices now calling for more action on a huge spectrum of action, and you're clearly on that spectrum somewhere of acting in some way against ISIS. You know, you supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003, a position that you later publicly regretted. What would you say to people who hear you and others who took that position now calling for action against ISIS and saying, we're not going to fall for that again?
I would say, well, what do you do? What's the response to ISIS? It's legitimate and also quite satisfying to look backward. If one was, you know, had the right view of the Iraq War, which is to say this is going to be a disaster, but that doesn't get you off the hook in having to figure out what do you do now, because ISIS exists and it's clearly not just a threat but a nightmare for the Middle East and getting stronger every day. And I think one would be very naive to imagine that it's going to remain confined, as you quoted me writing in The New Yorker, to the boundaries that it holds right now, a third of Iraq, a third of Syria. So what do you do? How do you respond? Well, diplomacy, is that going to get you anywhere with ISIS? It doesn't seem like that's their thing. You know, forming an informal coalition in which America is not out in front, but is using its assets and its ability to lead to get others to do what's in their interest and to be bold enough to do what's in their interest, that seems like something President Obama is well cut out to do and should have the support of the American people in doing.
George Packer, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate talking with you about this.
My pleasure.
George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of many books, including The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, and The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. I'm Isaac D.B. Aronson, sitting in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, it's been said that the tipping point at which the U.S. will become a majority-minority nation is decades away. But a new analysis finds that the tipping point may actually be tomorrow. Stay tuned.